Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to ATI Financial Radio, a plain English, no-nonsense approach to personal finance. Today is Friday, April 10th, 2015, and today's show is Charitable Giving, Doing Good While Saving on Taxes. I'm your host, Dina Isola, along with Tony Isola, and we thank you for being here today. We have a really busy show today. The topic, basically, money is not the root of all evil, especially when it's directed at a good cause. So today we're going to learn how you can make a difference while improving your tax situation. And also on the agenda is we're going to recap our educational seminar that we had last week, April 1st, and discuss the wonderful efforts of Stony Brook Children's Hospital, the Sunrise Fund, Make-A-Wish of Suffolk, and Lift Up Long Island. And we've got some other interesting tidbits to cover. Don't get fee-bezzled. You'll learn what that term is. What investors need to know about the rising dollar and what that means to their portfolio. Teaching your teens about budgeting before they leave for college. And the top three things that you should do with your tax refund. So we're going to kick off with Tony's blog. He's been picked up this week, very exciting stuff, by NASDAQ.com. And the title of his blog this week is Bull Market Fee Bezzlers Riding High for Now. Tony, what the heck is a fee bezzler? Because people do not know what that means. And where did that come from?
Well, a fee bezzler is someone who kind of overcharges you for your investment and in a way is kind of embezzling money. Even though it might not be illegal, it is certainly not the proper thing to do. And the term comes from a man named Charlie Munger, who has worked with Warren Buffett over the past 50 years. And he just kind of wrote something about, you know, he came up with that term, and he basically said, you know, these people are withdrawing all this money from investors' pockets, and then eventually they'll get caught, and who knows what's going to happen to them when they get caught. And in the end, what looks like, you know, a good thing as far as everybody's making money turns into something really bad. So that's where he came up with the term. And the reason I wrote about this is because the markets have done well the past few years, and many investors, you know, might have some very high-cost products. And when the market does well, the fees are kind of hit, and people don't realize what you're paying. But eventually, when the markets don't do as well, that's when you realize not only did you not make as much when the market was going up because of the fees, but in a much worse situation, when the market's down, now you're losing a lot more. So that's really the, you know, the whole point of the article, and it's, like I said, it's on NASDAQ.com, and I'll put it on my blog, Malice for All, so that should be on there today also. So if you haven't had a chance to read it, it's entertaining, and you'll probably learn a little something.
And not at all sarcastic. I'm
no, kidding. Not sarcastic at all. Never.
Moving on to economics, big buzz in the news is the U.S. dollar, and it's powering on and really strong. And investors probably are wondering what exactly does that mean to them, to their portfolio. Should they be doing something other than possibly planning a trip overseas where the euro is suffering? Tony wrote about this in our quarterly letter to clients and to anyone on our mailing list, and addressed, I thought, it very well, very succinctly, as to what's going on, what that means, and what you should be concerned about or not concerned about.
Well, basically, if you're a long-term investor, you really don't pay attention to these movements. You can get caught up in things, but over time, if you intend on holding a portfolio for the long term, which is what you should be doing, and not messing with it too much, the currency movements tend to cancel each other out. So right now the dollar is doing very well. It's rocketed up the past year or so more than it ever has done in a one-year period. And unfortunately, many investment products now are being created that are so-called hedged investments. In other words, when you buy a foreign mutual fund, it's in the local currencies like the euro. So in this case, they've created funds in which it would be in dollar terms, so you can take advantage of the dollar going up. But a problem with that is the dollar doesn't always go up, and when it goes down, now the reverse effect will happen and you'll lose money, and you also have to pay for a hedge, which can be very expensive. So basically, if you're a long-term investor, the dollar movement is just part of a cycle that happens, and sometimes the dollar goes up a lot and sometimes it goes down a lot, but over time it tends to even out. And really, you shouldn't be positioning your portfolio based on short-term movements of any kind, especially the currency movements, which could be very, very volatile. So, you know, like I said, if you're planning a trip, this is a really positive thing for you if you're going to a country where the dollar is appreciating again, such as, you know, the nations in Europe. So that would be my advice to you. You know, don't worry so much. You know, whatever you hear on the news, just, it's just noise and it has no effect on long-term planning. But it could help you out if you want to plan a trip overseas now, because obviously you can buy a lot more with the dollar than you could have last year. It's gone up over 20%. So just think of yourself going to Europe. You can purchase 20% more with that same dollar.
For large U.S. multinational corporations that do quite a bit of their business overseas, and who actually get paid in euro and then have to convert, this isn't such a great thing for them, right?
No. But again, many of those those corporations, they make a lot of stuff overseas also. Even though they're U.S. companies, they have many of their factories in other parts of the world. So it actually, you know, somewhat offsets. So like I said, this is a temporary thing, and if you hear anybody screaming and yelling about it on the financial TV or anywhere else, I would just really just, you know, find something else to listen to, because it's certainly not worth your while to listen to some hysterical person yelling about this.
All right. Well, moving on to the consumer tip, if you're one of those fortunate ones who are getting money back from the government this year and not having to pay, we have some tips, top three things to do with your tax refund. Number one.
Right. I mean, if you get a tax refund and you have some extra cash, the first thing I would do is look at some outstanding debt you might have. So, for instance, if you have credit card debt at 16 or 18% or even higher, paying that off with your tax refund immediately just got you a 16% or 20% return with no risk. So that's a no-brainer. So you just kind of have to look. I would look first at all of my debt and say, you know, what here has got a high interest rate relative to what's going on in the world? And the higher interest rate debt should be paid down, because it's like making a return, that same return on the money. And even if you don't have short-term, you know, credit card debt, if you have a home mortgage, and the rate is, you know, just an average mortgage rate, maybe 3 or 4%, you can still maybe make an extra payment with that tax refund, which could cut down the long-term interest costs considerably. So just making one payment and just bracketing that towards your principal only could substantially cut down the long-term costs of a mortgage. So those are a couple of, you know, couple of things you could do as far as paying off debt with a tax refund.
And don't forget car payments. That's also a good one to look at.
Absolutely, because a car is much that you really want to pay off, because your home has a chance of going up in value, and
right,
your car, unless you're collecting a car, but you probably wouldn't have a car loan if you were buying expensive cars. So, you know, it's going down in value. So yes, that would be a good idea too.
Our second suggestion is to fund your emergency fund. And we're asked this all the time, how much is the right amount to keep in emergency reserves? And it really does depend upon how you earn your living. Someone who is self-employed, for example, who may not have, say, disability insurance, would need a larger emergency fund in case they become temporarily disabled from working. Any thoughts you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, and also if your income relies on a big bonus and you don't get the bonus, so you would obviously need a bigger emergency fund. And just the opposite, if you're kind of, you know, maybe a teacher or a police officer or fireman or something with, you know, great job security, you might not need as much.
And coverage, too, in the event of an emergency.
Exactly. So, you know, it all depends. There's no hard rule, but most people would say, you couldn't go wrong but by keeping at least 6 to 12 months of income in somewhere where you can get at it and has no, the market would have no effect on the value of it.
And lastly, and we covered this last week too, fund an IRA, whether it be a traditional or a Roth. You really can't go wrong. You have until April 15th of 2015 to fund a 2014 IRA if you haven't already done so. And if you did fund it, good for you. You could certainly go about funding 2015.
Absolutely. So, you know, those are three pretty good options. And, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with taking some extra money and going on a vacation or purchasing something. But in the big picture, if you kind of get in the habit of taking that money and doing one of those three things with it, your wealth should grow, you know, considerably more over time than someone who just takes that extra money every year and buys a big screen TV or something.
There you go. Okay, we're up to Kids Cash Corner, and I think this is a really good way to get on track before summer creeps in. If you have a soon-to-be high school graduate and they're getting ready to go either away to college or not, maybe they're going to be commuting to school, handling their finances is probably in their not-too-distant future. So what can you do to get your students ready to handle money? First and foremost, I think it's important if you sit down and work out an actual budget so that the child will get a sense of what kind of expenses they have coming up. And also it's a good time to go over what you will be covering and what you are expecting your child to be covering. So, for example, if you're paying for books but you expect your child to pay for entertainment or meals out above and beyond their meal plan, say, it's important to carefully lay that out and also assign estimates to what they may need. And then a really good part of that is that it kind of sets an expectation for them what they need to earn during the summer months at their summer job and what they need to stock away and save in order to have enough money to last them through the school year. And lastly, if you haven't already done so, it would be a good idea to open up a bank account and kind of show them the ropes so that they know before they go away, if they're going away, how to balance a checkbook, for example, what they need to do, how to reconcile their statements against their activity in their checkbook. And it would be also a good time to decide whether or not a prepaid debit card or a very low balance credit card is appropriate for them. And again, a good idea to test drive this all before they're out there, especially if they're going away, where you're not going to be having these conversations routinely and they can't come to you and ask you every minute when they have a question.
Yeah, I think that pretty much sums it up. And just getting them in the habit of understanding that there's a limited supply of money and they have to learn how to ration it over time. So just, you know, you don't have to have this crazy budget with 100 categories. Just a basic plan where you say, okay, you've got $200 to spend this month, and that's it. You have to figure it out and give them some flexibility. So some months, some weeks, they might spend a little more on one thing and a little less on another. But what really needs to happen is they have to have that understanding that the money will run out unless they ration it in some form or fashion. And just getting into that habit will help them immensely before they get into college, because, you know, people are just woefully unprepared to manage their money. Many adults are, so never mind, you know, kids going off to college. So if you did that over the next, you know, 4 or 5 months, that would really be a big benefit when they're, you know, off on their own. And even, you know, managing it is a lot easier these days because most major banks and credit card companies have apps that can be accessed through smartphones at any time of the day or night. So it's a lot easier now than it was, you know, years ago, where people, you know, had to physically write things down in books and go to banks and much more inconvenient. So there's a lot of advantages out there today and helpful technology to help with this that kids, you know, respond to.
It'll help you breathe easier too, because there's a bunch of stuff that you cannot prepare for right now for September for them, you know, going off to college. But this is one thing that you can start now kind of get them up to speed, and it'll help you sleep easier at night, I think, knowing that they're in a prepared to handle this responsibility. And frankly, it's a lesson that you're going to teach them that's going to benefit them for the rest of their lives.
Right.
So it's really important.
A lot
that you
more
use
important
it
than a lot of the things they'll be learning in school, to be honest.
Okay, so now we're up to the main event. We had a tremendous evening last week, April 1st, at the Holiday Inn Express, and I have to thank them and John Tunis for donating the space and the food for the event, which is just really tremendous of them. We had a number of speakers, and we're going to do our best to recap what was discussed in the very limited time that we have, but we really wanted to fill you in on the different ways that you can give to charities, and there's something out there called a donor-advised fund that you may or may not heard of, if you want to maybe cover that.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, a donor-advised fund is for people who have money to give to charity. You know, I'm not talking about $50 or $100, but the donor-advised funds we speak about are a minimum of $5,000. So if you're looking to make a decent donation to a charity, if you put your money into a donor-advised fund, you get the immediate tax write-off. The donor-advised fund is looked at as the charity. So you get your tax write-off. You put the $5,000 in. Now, in addition to that, you have investment options, and you don't have to now distribute that money to the charities that you want it to go to. You can let it grow maybe for 10 years, and if it's invested properly over a 10-year period, there's a good chance it could double. So now you have $10,000 to give to a charity in 10 years. Now, you don't get another write-off, because that's where people get confused. Once you put that $5,000 in, that's your write-off. So if it grows in value, it doesn't matter what's dispersed from that donor-advised fund. But the whole idea is to give to charity and to give as much as possible. This is a no-brainer. And what's also great about it is if you set one up with the initial funding, then you could make small contributions to it, $100, $50, whatever you want to do, and all your record keeping is taken care of. So instead of having at the end of the year to scrounge around and find the receipts and letters and all the other acknowledgments, you have all of your charitable giving in one place, and the records are all there, and it's pretty simple, and you have the added benefit of you can involve your family in it and your children and whomever you want and research and take time and not be under pressure to disperse the money immediately, because who knows, down the road there might be some organization that doesn't even exist today that you might want to give to. So you can take your time, do your homework, but get tax benefits and record keeping benefits that are really important.
And a really great benefit, tax benefit, to the donor advised fund is it does not need to be funded using cash. It could be used, you could fund it using securities, for example, and that has its benefits, because if you're not the greatest record keeper in the world, you would have to find out what your cost basis is. That is, what price you paid for a security. But you don't need to do that when you put a security into a donor advised fund. So you could transfer in a security, and perhaps the security appreciated in value, so that if you had gone ahead and sold it, not only would you have to find the cost basis, but then you'd have to pay capital gains tax on it. So putting it into the donor advised fund eliminates both of those requirements, which is huge, and then you get the write-off at the full market value of the security, which is a huge tax benefit.
Yeah, and it's a double. You get a double dose for your money. You get a write-off, and you don't have to pay the capital gain. So this is if you're interested in giving to a charity and doing it in an efficient way, this is a tremendous opportunity. And what also is good about it is there are no setup fees for it.
And it's not like doing a trust or an endowment,
which can be
very, very costly.
Yeah, and complicated. So this is easy. You also have investment options that are relatively fair prices for them. So all in all, it's a winning deal for anyone who's interested in giving to charity and setting up a program to continue to give and really organizing it and doing it in the most efficient way, and hopefully getting the most money to the charity as as you possibly can. So, you know, it's, and people will say about, oh, the stock, why don't we give the stock? To me, it's the best way to do it, because if you have cash, you're not getting that extra tax benefit. So you'd be better off to take the stock that's appreciated, give it to the donor advised fund, and if you really like that stock or investment, take the cash you are going to use for the charitable donation and repurchase that security that you had. So you can get the best of both worlds. You don't have to just give that up forever, but you can give away. The gains will now be eliminated. You'll get your tax write-off, and you could still have the same investment if you so desire. So many benefits.
Donor advised funds can also handle some pretty different scenarios, such as real estate or collectibles could be put into a donor advised fund.
Business interests, privately held businesses, a lot of things.
Some of it gets really technical, obviously.
Right.
We're just touching on the possibilities, but there are a lot of options with the donor advised fund. And again, like Tony said, it's a great activity to get the family all involved in. And you don't have to choose just one charity. It could be dispersed however you see fit. It could be broken up among many charities.
Right. And again, you don't have to do it immediately. You could put the money in, get your tax write-off, and then take your time to let the money grow and do your research. So there's very little downside to doing this if you want to give to charity in a decent manner.
There's another way to give to charities. It's not within the donor-advised fund. In fact, it's not permitted in a donor-advised fund. The only issue is you have to wait year by year because Congress has to weigh in and approve
this.
But when you're receiving distributions from your IRA, so between the ages of 59 and a half and over, by at least age 70, you have to take your required minimum distribution from your IRA. And I'm talking about a traditional IRA, not a Roth. Those distributions are taxable to you when you take them out. However, for example, for 2014, Congress had approved that if you take the distribution directly from the institution that's holding the IRA and distribute it directly to the charity, that becomes a non-taxable event.
Yeah, and again, even, you know, Congress is, you know, very inefficient, not the brightest people in the world, and disingenuous, but usually they end up passing this at the end of the year. So even though there's a lot of drama and theater,
and they usually wait till the very last minute,
you know, it's
unfortunately.
Just, you know, it really hurts because there's some people who, you know, hold off doing it and may not do it, but the bottom line is, there's a good probability that, again, this year this will be enacted, and hopefully in the future, if they ever get their acts together, they'll make it a permanent part of the legislature that they pass. But like I said, it's I would count on it, you know, happening again. There's strong possibilities because it goes through this every single year.
We had a number of really engaging speakers at the event last week. And in full disclosure, for those of you who don't know us very well, we are out in Stony Brook, Long Island, which is in Suffolk County, which is farther from Manhattan than Nassau County. So it's important that you understand that, because a lot of what we're going to focus on right now happens to be what's going on out in the Stony Brook area. We had Danielle Holton, who is the Executive Director of Development at Stony Brook University Children's Hospital. The hospital was launched actually in 2010, and they're in the process of building a state-of-the-art facility that will open in 2016. And Danielle was really good at explaining how the hospital came about, that there's this population that really was not being served on Long Island. The nearest children's hospital, if you're out on the east end of Long Island, was basically in Nassau, but pretty much in Queens, so it could take you, you know, 2 hours to get there, depending upon where you live on Long Island. So clearly there was a need for it, and a children's facility is very different from an adult hospital. The children's hospital handles the needs of the entire family. There's a lot of, you know, emotional and psychological stress that goes along with having a child that's not well, and siblings and parents need support as well, and they're really trained in handling that. Even something like having a Ronald McDonald respite room in the facility, which as parents, you tend to live there because that's the only place you can grab a quick cup of coffee without, you know, running downstairs. It's important to have, you know, one in Suffolk County for that reason, like I said, because if you live out here and you have to travel far, you know, it kind of makes it difficult for you to have normalcy in your family life for both the patient and the family. So it's really important that the hospital gets built and built well, and they do incredible things there. They have specialties in kidney transplants and spinal surgeries and pediatric anesthesia. They do tremendous things there, so we were really lucky to have her with us. Dr. Robert Parker was there as well. He's the Director of Pediatric Hematology and Oncology at Stony Brook University Children's Hospital. Phenomenal man. Tony and I know him personally. We've been in his presence as he's diagnosing and treating, and he's just a very gracious and talented man. He informed us that currently Stony Brook handles 60% of the pediatric hematology and oncology patients in Suffolk County. So they're doing lots of things. They're actively involved in clinical research to improve the survival rates of children with cancer. They study the neocognitive effects of treatment on the children, as well as the effects of chemotherapy on bone density. He spoke at great length about the Sunrise Fund, which is really phenomenal. It's a fund that was founded by two mothers who had children that were being treated at in the pediatric oncology hematology ward. And they wanted to basically raise awareness of childhood cancers in the community and to raise funds to support pediatric cancer research at the hospital. And they've done tremendous things there. They've established the Dan Brooks Memorial Educational Award that graduates of the pediatric hematology-oncology program basically get a scholarship to defray the costs of post-high school education. They have a school intervention and reentry program to help children and patients reintegrate back into the school. And they educate the classmates about the child's illness so that understanding and empathy can be fostered. And this program is nationally and internationally recognized. Japan apparently is trying to duplicate the program, and there's no other program in New York State that comes close to this program. So they've been doing some really incredible things there. Corrine Hollander was also there. She is the CEO and president of Make-A-Wish Suffolk County, and the only thing I could really say about Make-A-Wish is that they're just little angels that come to grant a wish to children who are suffering from any life-threatening, not necessarily fatal, life-threatening diseases. Oftentimes people think someone has to be terminal, and that's simply not the case. They really do give the family and the child something happy and hopeful to look for when they're going through a very stressful situation. So it's a real happy distraction that allows the child to heal its heart. So they just do wonderful things, and there's many, many different ways that you can donate to Make-A-Wish. People donate air miles because, as you know, a lot of kids ask for to go to Disney World or travel somewhere. And this year on May 7th, they're doing their annual gala at Villa Lombardi's in Holbrook. It's Princess Nicolina's Royal, and that's a fundraiser. So there's many different ways you can donate your car to them as well. And lastly, Lift Up Long Island was there, and they're teaching children to undertake and champion a cause by creating a self-sustaining business known as a social venture. And ventures and social entrepreneurship is really becoming a concept embraced on college campuses, including Stony Brook University's College of Business, for building empathetic, creative leaders. So we encourage you to check these charities out. We're literally at the last minute, so we hope that you enjoyed the show and walked away with knowing what a fee embezzler is and knowing to build your emergency fund and pay off your debt with your tax return and learn some ways to give to charities.
Yeah, and not worry about currencies.
Yes.
That's another thing. And just in general, you know, a lot of this stuff is just common sense, like getting your tax return and doing something intelligent with it rather than buying something which will have no value in a short period of time. So hopefully, like I said, we're trying to, you know, put some common sense on all of these topics, and hopefully you learned something today.
Well, we hope you join us next week as well, and also encourage others to tune in to the radio blog. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a wonderful weekend.